What do you call a dog that does magic?
I don't know. What do you call a dog that does magic?
A Labracadabrador. Hey, everybody. Hooray! It's the Lovecraft Show. My name's Mr. Eggstitch.
And I'm Marianne. Hello, listeners.
How are you? It's been a while. It's nice to be back in your ears again. It's a bit of a warm one where we're recording.
It is. We are experiencing a bit of a sort of a British heatwave, not to be confused with anybody else's kind of heatwave.
I tell you what was a proper melon twister for me the other day. So on the Monday, we're recording this intro on a Friday. On the Monday, around my neck of the woods, we had a massive thunderstorm, like a really big one. It was huge. And like in about the hour before the thunderstorm, it was really, 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 really warm. And the thunderstorm included a hail shower. And it was like the hailstones were like the size of cherry pips. You were like, there's ice coming out of the sky. And it was really, really hot.
It's very strange, isn't it? And I remember being in the States when I was like much, much younger. And there was a colossal storm in Florida. But the rain was hot. Really, really hot rain. But here, we just it's like... Yeah, how weird is that ice?
I'm not a fan of hailstones as well because I have nothing to cushion their blows. So I actually ran out to get some hailstones to show the girls because they were like, you know, bits of sweet corn size, cherry pip size. But at the same time, I was utterly battered by all these small bits of ice just bouncing off my skull.
Yeah, so. Well, they can hurt. They come down with a pretty big force, don't they?
Yeah, I remember once I used to have a job working in a supermarket. And this was after, this is around the turn of the century when I rebooted my life. So I quit working in Canary Wharf and moved in with my mum. And I worked at Tesco's. And I'm 25. I've already worked in a supermarket as a kid. I'm back working in a supermarket. It was a Sunday afternoon. I was pushing trolleys round. And I was in a right grumpy mood about like the state of my life. And look how well done, Chalmers. You're 7 years out of uni and you're pushing trolleys around in a supermarket. Well done, Chalmers. And I was in a really grumpy mood. And then it started raining and I was like, God. And then it started hailing on me. And I was like, right, the universe, the gods are just shitting on me. I was just like, stop being grumpy about it. Because look, the grumpy you get, the more the weather beats you down or whatever. There's a seminal moment that. And I stopped caring at that point.
That's magnificent. And that really woke you up to the bliss and the beauty of life.
It really did. Once the headache had gone away from the barrage of hailstones. But that was a funny time in my life, which I don't speak about very often. But I completely just stopped working in London and completely quit and moved back in with my mum and started from scratch again. It was a funny adventure.
I think it's very interesting. We all have that, you know, we all know somebody who's completely turned their life around. And I think since the pandemic, everybody, as horrendous as the pandemic was, a lot of people, it's given a lot of people the impetus and the possibilities to turn their lives around and do other things. Mm. To actually sort of maybe just like take those dreams by the scruff of their neck and have a go. You know, set up on your own, do something, especially crafters, because obviously everybody had time then to make things if they weren't obviously incredibly ill.
Yeah, and so it kind of forces your hand. And I think, you know, when a certain mode of life gets taken away from you and then you have to start again, it's interesting to decide what to do, which is a beautiful segue into the story of our guest this week.
Indeed. This is exactly what happened to her. A big change came along and she turned her life around into another direction and ended up doing something she'd never, ever expected. So what you're about to hear is a fabulous interview with an incredible crafter and great designer called Brenda KB Anderson.
And it was really enlightening. Like, I love it's a really interesting chat. She's got a lot to offer. She's hugely creative. So we'll say no more. We'll just dive in and we'll see you on the other side, shall we?
Let's do it. Everybody, let's have a wonderful chat with the magnificent Brenda KB Anderson. Hello, Brenda.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here with you guys.
We're really excited to be here with you. But first of all, we've got to talk about the KB Anderson part, because we had this little conversation before we started about why you are Brenda KB Anderson. So tell us again, why are you a Brenda KB Anderson as opposed to a Brenda Anderson?
Well, I used to be a Brenda K. Bashinsky, and I had a friend who was Brenda K. Brenneman, and we always thought that was so weird that we almost had the same name and we kind of look alike. It was very strange. We met in college. And then I got married to someone whose last name is Anderson. And in the meantime, I hadn't seen her in years, but she got married also. And I bumped into her and she was like, hey, guess what? Our names are more different now. And I was like, yeah, mine's Anderson. She's like, mine's Anderson. Like, yeah, they're the same.
And he said, I got married on the 12th of July. And she went, I got married on the 12th of July.
Oh my gosh. It was weird. So yes, I usually go by the K and then the B are like my two middle names. So to differentiate.
And what does she do? Is she the one who I found in my extensive Google research? Is it true she's a paleontologist?
She looks probably kind of like me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that, yes. And we were just saying as well that, that you are notoriously hard to pin down because there's no paper trail for you. We can't find any deep secrets about you online. When we were researching, you've gone dark.
Yeah. Do you want to know what the real secret is? Is that I have a fear of social media. I mean, not really, but I'm just really bad at it. It's just not something that I naturally do. Unlike everyone else I know.
Is it possible that you spend your time producing magical crochet patterns so much so that in fact you are made of magic and it's well known fact that fairies don't like social media, is that?
Jamie, I'm looking out on you. I knew you'd know why that was. Yes. So Brenda, actually you are a magic Brenda. That's a differentiator between you and the other Brenda Anderson. She's not magic, you're magic.
Forever now known as non-magic.
Brenda Anderson, and I'm magic.
Mm-hmm. Now, before the reason that we desperately wanted to talk to you was because we caught sight of your new fabulous book that's coming out. It's coming out pretty soon, and it's called, now I've got to get this right because it just looks quite common, it's a Hooktionary.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the Hooktionary.
And so for crocheters in the world, this is a very exciting moment because all of us love Stitch dictionaries, but this one has a little extra pizzazz to it, doesn't it? So this is like amazing intarsia motif stuff that you can use for tapestry crochet. Tell us about it because it looks beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, so it's basically a collection. There's 150 different motifs that I made up that are just, I mean, they're kind of eclectic. There are some that are geometric designs. There are some that are like, you know, weird things like Bigfoot and bowls of ramen. But so it's kind of like
those things, don't they? Bowl of ramen in your jumper. Lovely.
I think so. Yeah. And Bigfoot. Maybe somebody wants to combine them in a sweater. That would be cool.
It's done now.
But yeah, I pulled together a bunch of, you know, kind of eclectic designs and shoved them in this book. And then I have an explanation of different ways to make your stitches. So I use single crochet through the back loop only, and I use something called center single crochet, or also called split single crochet, or it's like the waistcoat stitch basically. And then I also use front post double crochet and extended single crochet and split extended single crochet. So there's like five different ways to make your stitches, and then a whole bunch of different charts with images. And I kind of walk people through like what stitch combination you should use with the picture, if that makes sense. It's hard to talk about like the motif and then the stitch work itself, like how to combine those two to make a clear image. Because in crochet, it's kind of a, you know, all the stitches are asymmetrical. So it's not like, you know, in cross stitch, Jamie, I know you love cross stitch. It's not like, you know, you just have the X, the stitch itself is symmetrical. I mean, I know there's one crossing over the other, but when you look at, you know, the dark versus the light of that stitch is symmetrical. But in crochet, it's not symmetrical, you know, bilaterally or from top to bottom. It's really not symmetrical. So there's, you know, some ways around that because like the split single crochet makes it almost symmetrical. It's just like practically symmetrical. But most of our other stitches in crochet are not like that. So then when you put all these little pixels together, like just imagine a chart with a bunch of little pixels making up the picture, then because they're all asymmetrical, they hook together in different ways. It starts to kind of like blur your image or make your image veer off to the side or do all these other unpredictably kind of annoying things in crochet. It's not like in knitting, you know, your stitch has bilateral symmetry. And when you put all those stitches together, you can have a pretty good idea of what it's going to look like. But if you're using a crochet stitch, it just takes a little bit more knowledge about the stitches itself to understand what that picture is really going to look like when you crochet it up. And of course, you can do a swatch, but I know everyone hates doing swatches. So I just wanted to give people like a little more information so they could kind of like when they get a little more used to it, they can have in their mind like, oh, this type of stitch pattern, you know, this type of motif, this type of design, you know, motif of it, this would look good with this type of stitch because of the way these lines are made. Or
you'd make perfect sense to me, probably not to Jamie at this stage, but he's looking slightly glazed. But he
I've got the foggiest what the lady's talking about.
The reason I'm very excited about this is because almost every time we talk to anyone who does crochet, I always say this, Jamie, don't I, that crochet is one of those crafts where, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s, it was just blankets, doilies, and strange tank tops or shorts. You know, it was sort of like it belonged to the land of brown and orange, and that's what happened. Over the last few years, it has evolved so profoundly that all the things that were the province of knitting, the cables, the colour work, all of those sorts of things, people have very cleverly come along and said, do you know, we can do that with crochet because we do this and we can create these things. And then I remember way back when before Love Crafts, we had Love Knitting and Love Crochet. I remember talking to somebody when we launched Love Crochet and they said, oh, you can't do crochet cables. You can't do crochet colour work. And I was like, you actually can. And it's so clever and it looked really brilliant. But there is that moment where the colour work, I know exactly what you mean. It just doesn't look quite right. It's not as clean as knitting and it doesn't look quite right. And here you are with the next evolution of the crochet stitch, complete genius, making these stitches look better so that they work for colour work for Intarsia. It's absolute genius, Brenda. Where on earth did this come from? When did you suddenly think, do you know what? These normal stitches aren't working. I'm just going to have a fiddle about and make new stitches work.
Well, I first started doing color work. So I put out a book years ago now called Beastly Crochet. And in that book, there is a sweater, a sweater for a little kid, and it has robots on it. And I really wanted my robots to be like, you know, square looking, not like kind of veering off to the side in weird shapes. I really wanted them to have this really nice graphic square look. And so I tried swatching, you know, I swatched it in single crochet. I swatched it in like all these basic stitches that I've seen people use before with color work. And then at the same time, I was working on this other project where I had seen something called extended single crochet, which is very similar to a single crochet stitch, just like one little variance in making the stitch. And I like noticed how stretchy and flat it made the stitch so different just doing that one little tiny thing. I was like, wow, this is really different. And also the other thing I noticed was that my stitches were going straight up. Like in crochet, you know, when you go around and if you're crocheting in the round, they start to veer off to the side because all your stitches are asymmetrical. They're not, it's like the post of the stitch goes straight up and then the top of the stitch is just slightly offset. So every time you stitch into that, you get further and further off to the side. And I'm waving my hands all over the place to show these guys for anyone who's listening and you can't actually see what I'm doing. Not that that helps.
Don't listen while you're driving.
So then I was like, wow, this stitch actually like stacks straight up vertically. I was working on this at the same time I was trying to design that sweater. I'm like, I wonder what this would look like if I started changing colors. And I loved it because it was like a little flatter, had a little more drape, which was also, you know, part of the thing. Like I was making a garment and I really didn't want, you know, when you add that extra color in there and single crochet, I don't know. It was nice to have like a little bit more of a drape to it all, you know, inherently in the stitch because you're adding that extra color in there that makes it a little stiffer. So yeah, I kind of just figured it out for that book. And I was like, wow, I can actually make my stitches look really clean. And that stitch pattern, the extended single crochet, works so good if you want to make squares or anything that's got vertical elements to it, anything that's, you know, you really don't want it to look, I don't know, kind of messy along the sides. It just was a different way of, and it's such a minor little change in the stitch. So then I started submitting stuff to magazines and the editors, Interweave Crochet, they were like, oh, look at this. This is cool. And then they published a couple of the things that I did. And then they started talking to me about doing this book. So this was like right after Andrea Rangel, I hope I'm saying her name right, but she's a knitter and she put out this book called Alternates. And it was like, I just felt like she wrote that book for me. I mean, I know she did. She doesn't know me. But I was working on a project through Interweave, and that was published by Interweave. And they were like, hey, we really want to do, you know, a project using her Stitch Dictionary. And, but we want to do it for our crochet magazine. Would you be willing to do that? And so I was like, sure. And they sent me like an advanced copy. And I was just, my mind was just blown. I was like, oh my gosh, I love this book so much. Like she had all these really cool, like just things I wanted to make in there. And I was like, this is so, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And so then I started working on that. I published that project for Interweave. And then, yeah. And then after that, they were like, we should do a whole book that's like the sister version for crocheters. So you can explain how to use these different stitches and make something cool, you know, so it can be like the sister book to Andrea's book. So that's kind of like how it got started. But it was a very long meandering path since then, because Interweave got sold and all this stuff happened in between and things changed. So it was, I mean, like I literally started this book years ago. But
wow.
If Interweave hadn't have been sold, would you have only done like 75? Did it give you so much time that you managed to do 150 different designs? It's an incredible number.
It's a lot to stitch up. It takes a long time. Yeah. Especially in crochet, because the way you have to hold the yarn, it's just, I feel like it's not really as fast as knitting color work. But I mean, I guess it depends on the person doing it. But for me, it's a little bit slower because you have like more motions to do. But I don't know. Yeah, exactly. I would have just gone on and on.
But how,
what was that?
I'm an ignoramus, but you've got like a stitch that looks like a sprinkle covered jam donut. And you've got one that is a blue lightning flash.
Oh, yeah.
What kind of wizardry is this? How do you do it? How do you make a jam colored sprinkled donut out of crochet pattern?
Just, you know what? Okay, let me bring this back to cross stitch for you, Jamie.
Mm.
So when I was a little kid, this is a long answer to your question. When I was a little kid, like my sister and I, one of our favorite things to do was to take graph paper and make up crochet, or not crochet. We didn't even do color work then, but make up cross stitch charts and like little kits for each other. So we each sit in our little, our own little space, and we would make these like catalogs where we would take just regular graph paper and colored pencils, and we would like make these little pictures and then pull together the threads and bundle them up, and then like, we'd have this in our little, like a little catalog, and then we'd slip it under the other person's door, and they could look through the catalog, and then they would check off the ones they wanted to order. So we were really into that, like cross stitching when we were kids. And I just feel like, you know, it's very similar to that. You're looking at a graph and you're just trying to figure out how to make the picture you have in your head. And you just have to, and you know, it's easier now because I can do it on my computer and not just with graph paper. So I don't have to erase it.
Because you've got the mechanics of the, you know, straightness of the crochet as opposed to the skew, then it is very much just pixelation from that point.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, for the different stitches, learning, it was a long time of me swatching and swatching and swatching and swatching and learning, like, you know, after 4 hours on a swatch, I'm like, oh, that's not going to work. You know, throw that one out, you know, do it again. And it's like, there was so much trial and error with the different other stitch patterns, because some of them lend themselves very well to certain shapes that you have in the graph more so than others, you know? So that was a lot of trial and error. And I started learning like, oh, this stitch is really good if you have like, you know, fine lines and they're in a curve, like the dots will look like they connect. This one is good for objects that have like a line that slants to the left. This one is good for things that slant to the right. So it's like, just, and I do have information about that in my book so that people can see, you know, if they're coming up with their own, then they can kind of look through and be like, oh, this would probably be good for this type of stitch pattern. They can swatch with that instead of trying like a million stitch patterns and eventually winding up there.
It sounds like the sort of thing every now and again, there's been stuff where I've learned and I have like a moment of clarity where I see it. And then it goes again, you know, for a minute you understand a complex thing that someone told you. It sounds like you've got the moment of clarity kind of in there pretty well bedded due to your experience.
Yeah, I mean, it was because there was a lot of non-clarity going on over here at my house for a long time trying to figure it out. Like, I'd be like, oh, I think I understand this. And I'd just watch another one and be like, why is this like this? And then I started really looking at how the stitches interlock and, you know, what this anatomy of the stitches are and how they fit together. And then that made a little more sense to me as to why some things look really pixelated and some things look smooth. And, you know,
did you dream about it? Because sometimes it feels like it's the sort of thing that then someone dreams about it and they go, oh, I just worked that out in my dreams.
Oh, I'm sure I did. I dream problem solve a lot of weird things. Yeah. Like it just happens. But yeah, but it's probably just because I work so late and sometimes I'm not really sure if I'm actually awake or if I am dreaming. Just sort of a state of delirium.
Let me just reassure you both. That's just young children. That passes. So let me go back in time, because that story about your sisters, oh, how cute was that? But if we go back in time, so what was Brenda doing? What were you doing after, you know, what did you do before you were crocheting or before this great crochet career came upon you?
So you mean like what was my other career? Okay, so after I graduated from college, well, I went to school for clothing design, and I always kind of had in my head that I was going to work in like theater or something like that. And then I just sort of fell into this job where I worked in a costume shop, and we'd made like live touring shows, and we did Sesame Street Live. That's what they started out doing. And then we did all kinds of like mascots for, you know, professional sports teams. And we did Care Bears Live, My Little Pony Live, Curious George Live. Paw Patrol was the last one really that we, well, not Paw Patrol. And then we did Trolls Live. We partnered with Nickelodeon for a lot of shows. So that's what I did for like more than 20 years. I did that all the way up until COVID, like from when I graduated college, I did that. And then I did like, you know, crochet and knitwear design in the middle of the night on my couch, like in my free time. And then the pandemic hit and we all lost our jobs because you can't have, I mean, our jobs were based on touring shows that toured all over the world, big arenas. You couldn't do any of that, of course. So yeah, we all lost our jobs and, you know, we kept thinking, oh, this is just, you know, like I think a lot of people were thinking at the beginning, like this will just be a firm month and we'll just like, get back on track. And then it just kept going on. You know, they packed up, like we had just not too long before the pandemic hit, our company was bought by Cirque du Soleil.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Lovely.
Wow. Big league.
So we were all like, at first, we were a little nervous because it was a different thing, you know, like, oh, we're owned by somebody else. But then we loved it because they had just this great, you know, all these opportunities that we didn't have before. And, you know, we got all this new equipment and we were producing all, you know, we hired a lot more people and it was just really crazy. And we moved into a new shop, and which was really exciting, we had a big space. And but, you know, then right after that, the pandemic hit and we were all like, nobody had a job. And so there were a lot of us who had been there for a long time. Like I had been there for more than 20 years. And it was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with my skill? Like I have this weird niche. Like I developed costumes there is what I did. So I would look at designs or turnarounds from the company and try to figure out how to make them so that a person could fit in them, first of all. Because sometimes there were things like logos or just weird things that, you know, like it doesn't fit on a, or, you know, like, do you know Paw Patrol?
Mm-hmm.
Like the dogs from Paw Patrol. So like when you look at those dogs, you think, well, that's not going to fit on a human body unless you're standing up. And then they look, you know, so it was fun to have that challenge of like, just trying to figure things out, trying to figure out how are you going to make this work on a person? And I just went down that road for 20 years working on like all these cool costumes and things. And I loved my job. But then when I was done, I was like, what the heck am I going to do with my skill set? Like, this is so, like, what am I going to do? Like, my computer skills were practically non-existent. I mean, like basically I was working with actual materials on sewing machines, you know, foam and glue and in the sort of this, I was constructing things, you know, I wasn't, yeah, brushing up my other skills at all. So I was like, wow, what am I going to do? I don't know. So, but then, you know, the pandemic hit and I was actually thankful to be able to be at home with my kids and not have to go into work for a while. So that was nice. So my husband was still working, but so then I kind of just figured, well, I got to figure out something now. But then as I was trying to figure it out, another weird opportunity just fell in my lap and I was contacted by somebody at, well, it's called TN Marketing, but they were looking for somebody to start making crochet videos for them. So that's actually what I'm doing now. So I'm working for this website called The Creative Crochet Corner, and I'm their managing editor. So I do a lot of live events and I teach people how to crochet and I come up with new projects and we have, you know, it's on YouTube and Facebook and all over the place and people can join in and make stuff along with me and ask questions because they're live. Yeah. So that's what I'm doing now. It's kind of been a crazy ride, but, and I never, ever, ever thought that I would be even just able, like, I'm kind of shy and just, you know, when they first approached me about doing these live events, I was like, oh my gosh, like my stomach hurts already. I don't know if I can do that. But I was like, well, it's a job that I can do. Like I can figure this out. I can do this.
I completely understand that because I'm a writer. I'm a copywriter. That's my trade. And all the time I was at Lovecrafts, what I've ended up doing now is making all the YouTube videos and all the tutorials and things like that. And there is that moment where you just think, how did I get here? You know, that it's such a random thing to do.
Yeah. How did this happen?
But it's great. It's lovely. But you will, I'm sure, have such a thrilled audience. I mean, they must just absolutely love your tutorials. And live as well is so great because people can be like, oh, wait, I'm stuck. What do I do now?
Yeah, and they can ask questions right then. And it's nice because, you know, when you're teaching something, you're coming at it from the perspective of you're the one who made it up. So you just already know, you don't even have, you know, you have it in your head how it's made. And then it's sometimes hard to take a step back and think, how is somebody who didn't come along with my brain as I was making this up, what are they going to think of this process? Like, are they going to be able to understand what I'm telling them, you know? So it's nice to have people just be able to jump in and be like, could you talk a little more about this? I got lost, or, you know, what does this mean? So having had a
look through your Ravelry patterns today, I'm really in love with this one that I really, this lovely taffy swancho that I love.
Oh, thank you.
I think I'm going to have to make that. So you've got some good.
That's a fun one. It's a really fast and it's so like, it's so roomy and comfy. It's like if you wanted to wear a blanket and go outside of your house and not look like you're wearing a blanket, that's the project.
Bring on the blankets, I say. But you've got some great, great patterns in here. There's some really lovely patterns, great sort of range of smaller projects. So people can just...
I was quite impressed with the sunshine photo frame. That was a bit of a mind blower to me.
Thank you.
I never really thought about that. I like it. It's good. I'm a fan of macrame. I can appreciate a good plant hanger. You know, we have a few of those in our house. My wife is quite tasty on that. Those photo frames are like right in that zone.
Do you know what? Just one of the things, one of the things I love here is what we would say a dahlia, but you might say a dahlia. Face scrubby. What a great idea. There are lots of crocheted face scrubbies, but that's a great texture. So that's actually going to scrub your face.
Yeah, I wanted it to be really bumpy.
Absolutely amazing. I love your patterns. I think the people at Creative Crochet Corner are extremely lucky. Yeah. So when you were working on all these other costumes, and I mean, you've got a great mixture of toys and garments and home things. And what do you like making the most?
I think I really like making toys the most. I just, you know, it's funny because like I'm a really practical person. So, and now my house has so many toys in it. I mean, just so many because I've made a lot. And every time my kids see me making one, they're like, oh, can I have that, Mom? So I kind of like have to hide when I'm crocheting so they can't see it so I can give it away to somebody else without feeling guilty because we have too many in our house. But it's so fun to make something out of yarn that it's like a ball of yarn. There's no personality there. I mean, there is some, but it's not like a creature. You know, and to just take this long piece of string and make it into something that people see and immediately have a reaction to, like they want to hug it or laugh or be like, what is that? You know, it's just, I don't know. There's just nothing like that, really.
And that Beastly Crochet book that you did, that's like an intersection, obviously, between your old world and your new world then. Your amigurumi skills are strong, I believe.
Yeah, so... I did make a lot of amigurumi, and then at the time that I sent in my submissions for, because I really wanted to make a book, and I sent some in to Interweave, you know, because that was my first choice. I was like, I really want to work with them again, so I sent some things into Interweave, and I really wanted to do like an accessories book, and then I got this really nice rejection letter saying, you know, this is really great, but this marketplace is really saturated, you know, blah blah blah, and I was like, oh okay, that's probably what they say to everybody, and then like. Maybe less than a month later, just like a couple weeks later, I was contacted by the same person. She's like, I know you don't know who I am, but, you know, I'm the acquisitions editor for Interweave. And, you know, I've seen some of your stuff and I'd be really interested in working on a book with you. Have you ever thought about doing this? And I was like, she doesn't realize that the rejection letter was to me. Nice.
That was the other Brenda K. Anderson.
Because at first I was like, oh, wait a minute. Is this about what I sent in? No.
No.
Okay. And then I'm like, should I like tell her she already rejected me?
No.
I was like, no, why would I tell her that?
It was the other Brenda. It was clearly the other Brenda Anderson.
Yeah. Definitely not me. So then I was like talking to her and she had seen some of my toys and then she knew where I worked. You know, she knew I was working on Sesame stuff and other critter creature things. And she really wanted to do a book about, you know, she really wanted to play on that. She's like, I want this to come from you. I don't want to tell you what to do, but I am really excited about where you work for your day job. And, you know, what do you think about that?
If you can do a big like, okay. bird of some sort, you know, just putting that out there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how that one came about. It was really Allison was, you know, kind of suggesting it. And I was like, you know what, this is very me anyway. Like I sent in the other package of, you know, all those accessories because I was excited about that too. But I was like, I don't know if anyone wants to publish these weird critter things that I, you know, like I thought that was my best little package, sending them to her. Like, she'll really like this. And then she's like, no, I actually wanted what you really wanted to do. Come on.
What's so interesting, you know, is we were talking to a really lovely Polish crochet designer a little while ago when recording for season 4 called Anna Nikipirovich. And she was saying she's just done a Tunisian stitch dictionary. And she said the best thing about doing any kind of dictionary is that it lives forever. Whereas, you know, you do a book of projects, it has a sort of a life. It might not get republished. But any kind of dictionary will live forever. So you actually end up with, you know, reprint, and it goes on and on and on. So this new book is also a great sort of investment of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope it lives on forever. I mean, I think it'll give people a lot of good information about it. And, you know, I think there has been just like this big explosion of color work and crochet. And I think a lot of people are leaning towards mosaic style crochet, which I love too, and is very cool. But this book is tapestry. And for people who wanted to do tapestry, I feel like people kind of got away from doing that a little bit because, you know, they were not, the images that you make are just not as clear with, you know, single crochet as they are with mosaic. But if you try out these other stitches that I have in the book, they might be surprised at how clear and clean that they can be. So yeah, I hope that it's a tool that lots of people use. I love the idea of, you know, just the whole idea of the history of crochet and knowing that all these people in the past have worked a little bit and learned more and more. And since people started actually publishing things and writing them down, like I have this big stack of antique crochet projects, you know, and sometimes when I feel like I need to just change up what I've been doing, I'll just flip through those and look at, like, you know, what somebody published back in the 30s or 40s. And just, I mean, it's so cool that it's so timeless, you know, just even like you said, the projects, maybe I wouldn't be making, you know, like the same kind of doilies for my couch or whatever that's in that thing. But like, I can look at the stitches in the projects and pull parts of that out and use that for something that I want to make. Like
that's what's so brilliant, this sort of evolution of stitches and of the craft carries it into the future, makes sure that it will carry on into the future, which I think is just brilliant. It's like with, for knitting, you know, everybody was using double pointed needles for socks all that time until somebody, so Jamie's laughing because I'm always going to get socks in somewhere. Yeah. And and now you can use a long circular needle and work magic loop to make your life much, much easier. And it's just the way these things, people sit there and have a brilliant idea and then take it forward. And then you've suddenly got a new technique and something. And I think this is your book, is going to give that to a lot of people. They're going to realize because they can get their images looking crisper and better, and color work will evolve in crochet. I think that's wonderful. How did you ever knit? When did you start crocheting?
Oh, yes, I do knit. I love knitting. Yeah, I love knitting. But for me, like, my design brain goes more towards, like, it comes easier for crochet for some reason. I mean, I've published quite a few knitted toys and things like that and some other knitted accessories. but most of my design work is crochet.
I think that does lend itself to 3D, doesn't it, crochet? It's much easier to crochet something.
It just seems easier than knitting for making those kind of toys. I mean, you can certainly do it. Like this guy. I've got this little, my little friend here.
Oh, he's lovely.
This little guy. And he's got his little pajamas.
And little bunny slippers. For the benefit of you listening, there's just, we're having a look at these beautiful toys that Brenda's made. They're so cool. Yeah.
It's called Yeti for Bed. Oh. So it's a little Yeti and he's ready for bed.
Everybody will want one of those now. A Yeti for bed.
When you're doing your research, because I feel like if you're going to do like a Hooktionary, then after a while there's a certain sense of responsibility that falls on you. Like you say, it's a pretty big tome. So when you look back at some of the designs of the past, were there certain ones that really resonated with you or ones that influenced you more that you didn't anticipate?
Things that I've designed in the past?
No, I was thinking more like the designs when you were looking back at designs from way back. Did you find there were influences that suddenly kind of swept over you that kind of caught you by surprise at all?
Yeah, I mean, there actually, I don't know if this is exactly what you're asking, but kind of. There's this guy, I think his name is James Walters, and he was a crochet designer or instructor in like maybe the 60s. But my mom found this book. It's like got a picture of him. He is literally wearing like a leotard kind of full body unitard thing made out of crochet. I mean, and he just, it's just like, I was like, what is this book? Okay, I got to look in here. And I was like, just not really expecting to be like super wowed by this book, but I was. I opened it up and he had all this information in there about making interesting three-dimensional shapes. It was just like mind-blowing looking through this book. I was like, I mean, I have no idea what he's doing. I haven't looked him up. I should really look him up and see like if he's still making stuff. I have no idea. But when I saw that book, I was just like, you know, I was not fully prepared for how much my mind was going to be blown by looking through that book. I was like, this is just like, I don't know. It's just like changed the way that I thought about putting stitches together and learn. Like he had all these little hand drawn, because this is like before everyone had computers for all their digital design stuff. He had all these little tiny hand drawn charts in there. And I mean, that's just so much earlier than I remember ever seeing crochet charts. I was like, who is this guy? This is amazing.
That is because, yeah, charts. Yeah, absolutely. You didn't see that. And also just sort of like going 3D. Yeah,
there was so much stuff in there, like how to make a 3D thing twist around, how to make it. I mean, just, I don't even know. But I looked at it and I was like, this is like, I had already kind of gone down the path of making amigurumi at that point and understanding how to make three-dimensional shapes. And part of like, being able to design that already came from my day job, you know, just understanding pattern making and how, like, where things need to get bigger or smaller. I mean, it's really not that different than sewing, you know? I mean, it is because you're making it stitch by stitch, but just understanding the map of like the outside skin of something, if that makes sense, like the covering of something, if where it has to get bigger and smaller and how much, like, to change the shape. So I already kind of had that in my head, and I had already made some like kind of complicated, interesting three-dimensional shapes. Like I had made unicorn horn that twists around and looks like a spiral kind of coming up. I had figured out how to do that. But then when I saw this book, I was like, wow, this is like, he put on paper what I can like, feel like I barely understand enough. Like I barely understand enough to get the shape. And then I can write down what I did. But he like, I don't know, the way he breaks it down in that book, I was just like, I can't believe this existed. And I struggled for all this time, like, you know, trying to figure all these things out. And here it was in this book from like the 60s.
It kind of reminds me a bit of like the work of Claes Oldenburg, who was a sort of a soft sculptor who passed away not that long ago. But I think he was quite prevalent in the 70s. It would do like giant light switch made out of like soft things or giant apple core and just really expanding what could be built, and at the same time teaching everybody these kind of construction methods. Because I guess, yeah, when you're making creatures in a Sesame Street style or whatever, there's a certain construction that's piece, but then when you're transforming it, because you're making surfaces, aren't you, and then filling them, as opposed to what, making objects and then covering them, is that right?
It's kind of like, it's kind of both. Like, so I, my specialty at you know, my costume shop job was bodies, working on bodies. So I had to figure out how to look at, you know, whatever's between what their character head and then what are they wearing on their feet and figure out how to make that stuff. So if it was something like, you know, really big and round, like I would mathematically figure out how to make that three-dimensional shape. And then I would draft it out on paper. And then I would take this brown sort of thick paper and cut it into the pattern pieces and tape it together and put it on a dress form or put it on something and look at it. And then be like, well, this is all wrong, and then draw all over it and then cut it all out. And then, but basically I was making the pieces that usually we would be using some sort of softer foam trapped within mesh. And then we would put whatever covering goes over that. So like we'd be making the shape, like the outer shape basically of the thing so that it's hollow on the inside. Cause you're not, it's not, you know, when somebody's wearing a costume like that, they're not, you don't want to fill it all in with stuffing or something because it's so hard to move and it's so hot. So you try to make like sort of the outer shell of whatever it is you're making. So I don't know if I even answered your question.
No, but it makes sense because I guess that's the thing. Then you've got this innate ability when it comes to creating creatures and using, like you're making the surfaces again, aren't you? Except this time it's like a single strand of wool that's been turned into whatever. But I guess that's the intrinsic understanding. Yeah. I know of like a guy called Luke Haynes, who's an excellent art quilter, but he studied as an architect. So he's kind of like the part of his brain that learned how to put things together has come and then turned into doing quilts. And I guess it is the same transformation with you.
Yeah, I had this professor in college and she was like, if you're a really good designer, you can design anything. Mm. You know, and I was like, that's just silly. But like the older I get, the more I'm kind of like, yeah, you learn about like what makes something look good, like the aesthetics of something, proportion, all that kind of stuff. And that's part of your design, sense of design, but also the problem solving part and figuring, like learning how to see things in three dimensions. If you're making a three-dimensional thing, like how to visualize that, or, you know, what changes you should make it have a different shape, or, you know, just, I was like, okay, maybe that is kind of true. Like you've trained your brain to think about shapes and form and design in a certain way, and you can apply that to lots of things.
So, yeah.
And now that you've got every single crochet pattern known to man within your arsenal as well, presumably there isn't a single thing on the planet you can't make. So we'll have to challenge you. Can you? I'd like the Eiffel Tower covered in small cacti, please. And you'll be like, certainly.
I can do that for you. Going to take a while though.
Is there something that you've always wanted to make that you haven't made? It's something that's sort of like the pinnacle of when I make this, you know, that'll be the pinnacle.
That's when I've really made it. Yes.
Like, Jamie's Eiffel Tower covered in cacti. Yeah.
It's probably that. Yeah. No, you know, I really love, I mean, I've always really loved art. And when I went to college, I was like almost an art major. And I really miss the part of creating and making things that is not at all. Okay, what am I trying to say? I don't really make things anymore that are just for me, for the art of it, for the, like what it means to me anymore. I mean, like purely that. Okay. Like I do, what I make now are like, I make projects that I like making. I enjoy making them. Sometimes I make weird things just to make me laugh, but I'm thinking in my head, like, you know, this is my job now. This is how I make income for our family. Like, I have to be making something that people are going to care about. I can't just like. Yeah.
I'm going to use my posh voice now. It sounds to me like you're pivoting towards a design sensibility rather than an artistic bent.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where I kind of got funneled into, you know, because this is my job now. And it's not like, I'm not like calculating, like, what do people really want to see? You know, I'm going to make that. But, you know, I'm always thinking in my head when I'm coming up with designs, I censor myself. You know, I think of these crazy things. I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to make that. And then I'm like, nobody's going to care about that.
But you do have to do that. You do have to do that as a commercial designer, don't you? You've got to make something where people are going to buy the pattern. So if you spent hours and hours making a pattern for, I don't know, the Eiffel Tower covered in cacti, you know, that wouldn't necessarily be on everybody's list to make. Apart from Jamie. But so when you do for Creative Crochet Corner, so you're under pressure to create projects for that constantly. Do you find that hard, having to come up with something? How often do you have to create a pattern?
So I usually do between 3 and 4 demos a month there. So yeah, it's not, I have absolutely no problem coming up with gazillions of ideas. I have just this list on my phone in the notes section that's just going on and on and on and on with all these, like, I come up with an idea, put it in there. I'll never have time to make most of those things. But the thing that is the most time consuming is, for me, is writing the pattern, because I'm one of those people who, like, the concept of math, like, if I can visualize it. I was really good at story problems and that type of math, but then, like, grading things and proofreading my stuff, I mean, like, that just, it just takes so long. I mean, obviously I have a tech editor, Jen Lucas, who is amazing. She's so good at catching, I mean, you should just see the difference between the patterns I send to her and then what she sends back. I mean, I have, you know, it's funny because I say this, and like at my costume shop job, people would ask me, they would come over and ask me math questions a lot, because I understood geometry and I understood how to look at, like, this drawing on a paper and figure out how to make the pattern pieces to make it a three-dimensional thing. Like, I could do that kind of math, but then it's just like the part about looking through your pattern for any mistakes and making sure it fits all the sizes and all the numbers. It's like my brain just shuts off, and like, I have a really hard time. I don't know. It's just like, I just get distracted. So that's the part that takes me a long time. I come up with my ideas. I mean, I always have lots and lots of ideas. I never really have a time where I'm like, oh, I can't think of anything to make. Like, that doesn't happen. But I mean, and that's a, you know, I'm very thankful for that, because I know that that's, you know, a struggle for a lot of other designers is just, you know, sometimes they just get like a block and they can't think of another thing to do. Yeah, I have lots and lots of ideas. It's just that I need to be smart about what ideas I actually make, because I have a tendency, especially at the beginning of my designing career, of making things that I just thought, oh my gosh, this is just so different and interesting. I have to do this. But then the pattern is like pages and pages and pages, you know, and most people aren't really looking for something like that. They want to look at something and be like, oh, that's really cool. And then if they find out, you know, it's much easier than it looks to make, then they're like, oh, okay, I'm going to do that. You know, I mean, not that everyone's like that or anything, but I think that I have to kind of censor what I'm making, because sometimes I get a little too, I start realizing as I'm writing the pattern, you know, when I make the sample, no big deal, because I can figure it out as I go. And then I'm like, how is this going to fit on other body types, you know, other than the one that I made it for, which is mine? You know, I'm kind of, you know, an average size, but you know, you have to think about, how is this going to be accessible to other people, you know, and are people going to be able to follow these instructions? Are they going to want to follow these instructions?
When you said about how you have to consider people of different sizes, I can't help imagining if maybe you have to have a post-it note that says, only 2 arms. Do not make this for people with 6 arms. They're not real. They're in your imagination. I could see you quite easily spiraling off down a dimension that goes up.
Well, at my old job, that would have applied at my old job. I mean, we made things with multiple arms.
There's not many humans with multiple arms. But the interesting point I think you made there as well is the concept of making it easier than it looks. Because I feel like we're handing on this craft as we go to younger people, to this sort of younger generation of people who are coming in and they're really, really desperate to make things. Sometimes I think you see it a lot with knitting. People embrace the sort of super chunky, fast finish, quick projects, you know, because it's really satisfying, because they are used to having something that's fast finish and quick, and they can just make it and it's woo, and it's not particularly tricky. So actually there is that sort of moment of thinking, you want to introduce something that's more complex, but you also, so you've got like different audiences now, where you've got, you want to make something for the younger people that are looking for a fast, quick finish. There would be some of those people who want something challenging. And then you've got people that are seasoned crafters who want something that's ridiculously challenging. And so somewhere along the line, yeah, you've got to fit all those people in and make the designs easy. I suppose it's just such a big crafting audience. I love the fact that we've got this giant big crafting audience that's just growing. And I also love, and we've talked about this a lot, Jamie and I, the cross-pollination of crafts. So we were talking to someone the other day about crochet and embroidery and bringing cross-stitch and embroidery onto crocheted fabric or onto knitting.
Yeah, I actually did a live on, I crocheted like this kind of like a wider, not a, like, what am I trying to say? A pot holder, like just like a long rectangle for putting a casserole dish on. And then I had this cross stitch emblem that had a word on it on top that we cross stitched into the fabric because I found a fabric. I did some swatching and I found a fabric that made these perfect little squares so you could make your little X's on it. So I actually did, I did one of those. And then I've also been working, I've done this on a few things like knitted projects and crochet projects, both where I take purchase lace, like lace from the fabric store with like a kind of a bigger floral motif or something. And I'll pin that to my crochet or my knitting. And then I'll use that lace as like a paint by number template. And then I'll fill in with embroidery on top of the lace. Like the lace just stays there forever. But you do, if you buy it in a color that's similar to either what you're embroidering or similar to the background color, then you don't even really see it later. But you can just pin that on and then just embroider on top of it in whatever colors, changing your color, you know, however you want to do it. And that way you can get something that, you know, it's all marked out for you. It doesn't fall into all the holes of the crochet and the knitting, which is kind of a problem. And, you know, when you're embroidering on those things, you have to be so careful about your tension. And it helps with that a little bit too, because, you know, you've got that lace piece and you can watch and make sure that it's not crumpling. So you're keeping your stitches loose enough. And then you can also, has the bonus of like, you can take that piece and flip it, you know, even if your flower is like facing this way, if it's like an asymmetrical flower, but you can cut it out and look at it from the back of the lace and then make, it's like if you're going to put it on two fronts of a sweater or something like that, you can make mirror images and embroider one on each side and make sure they're going to match and make sure they're the same size. And
that's,
yeah. So I love experimenting with all that, like multimedia, bringing together different crafts together.
I could see you busting out a bit of conductive thread and or an Arduino circuit and suddenly making something that illuminates if you're in a good mood or something like that.
That would be, now that you've given me the idea, yeah, I should do that.
I know people. I did a little bit of casual research while we were talking and I just wanted to shout out James Walters, a crochet pioneer.
That's it.
Was the book that you liked, was it the New Crochet Workshop in which he sat in his thing with a massive pipe in his mouth?
Yes. And the back of the, can you see the back of the book?
I can't. I can only see the front cover on the book on this global retailer, unfortunately.
I'll just have to email you a picture of it because he's holding a bunch of balloons.
Oh, no, I've seen that picture. He's got an outfit on. This is an article I was reading in Crochet Worlds. Hot diggity. I wish I could show you that outfit. It's the sort of thing that only a man like him could wear. Apparently, so he was Welsh, and apparently he won a nationwide knitting and crochet competition in the 70s, participated in a BBC TV series, Marion, in 1976 called Knitting Fashion, where I believe the balloony outfit might have been part of the ensemble or whatever.
Probably from the 70s, yeah.
It sounds like he was a right sort of firebrand, but also him and his designer partner, Sylvia Kosh, were like, they were just out there. They were just like at the frontier of it. And just, I think they coined the phrase scrumbling, which is just making it up as you go along, changing yarn weights and all those sorts of things. And
okay, I didn't realize that came from them. Yeah,
he sounds like he was a right pioneer.
Yeah, yeah, he was a genius. I mean, genius. Yeah, don't be fooled by the crocheted leotard.
Don't wear it in the water, children.
In what universe could you ever say, don't be fooled by the crochet leotard? That's just got to be the best line of any podcast, Jamie.
Shout out to Tom Daly, whose ears have pricked up all of a sudden now.
He would make a crocheted leotard. Yeah.
He'd be like, what? Can I ask a random question? Because in the absence of finding out any detailed research, I wanted to ask you. So I obviously have a jet set playboy lifestyle, and if the X-Jet one day decided to land in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I wanted a spot of lunch and I wanted something that summed up the area, would I be better choosing the Siberian pelmeni from Moscow on the Hill on Selby Avenue with a horseradish vodka on the side, or should I go for the classic smoked chicken pot pie at the Lexington on Grand Avenue?
Oh, I don't think I've been to Moscow on the Hill, but I've heard lots of good stuff about it. But I have had the chicken pot pie and it's delicious.
It's been around since like the 1940s or something, that pot pie.
Yeah, it's pretty old school in there. That is like, yeah, there aren't that many restaurants that last that long.
No. Well, to be honest, I mean, give shout out St. Paul. There's a few by the sounds of it. Like not many, but more than the average, I think. It sounds like.
Yeah.
It sounds like Moscow on the Hill. If you want your Russian, if you want a good borscht.
Then you go there.
But maybe chicken pot pie. That's fair. That was all my saying. I ask that question because I feel like, you know, one day it's going to happen.
Oh, of course. Well, you have that jet, Jamie. You'll be flying around the world, or what's left of the world.
The jet.
Yeah.
The jet is in my mind. Oh, and then the other thing I was going to ask you, apparently you love road trips. What was the last good road trip you went on?
Well, last summer, my sister and her kids and my mom and me and my kids, we all packed ourselves into a van that we rented and we drove across the country and we went to Seattle. My cousin was getting married and it was amazing. I hadn't been on a road trip since before I had my kids. So, I mean, it might have even been like a real road trip. Okay. Okay. In my mind, a real road trip is like you put your stuff in the car. Maybe you make reservations. Maybe you don't. Maybe you just put your stuff in the car and then you just go and then you figure out where you're going on the way. This is how our family did it when I was growing up. We would like pack the van. Hopefully my brother would remember his shoes. One time he didn't. And then we would drive and then like sort it out where we were going to stay. So, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out. You end up sleeping in the van. But sometimes it works out really well and you see all kinds of really cool things that you just didn't know you were going to see because you weren't looking, you know, you didn't make reservations. You just stopped in some weird town. And then you ask people, what should we do around here? Or what's a good place to eat? Or, you know, so I really like I love the idea of not planning things, but now it's gotten so much harder. I feel like, well, now that I have kids, I don't really like the idea of us sleeping in the car as much as I used to.
Which your parents couldn't have been bothered about. They were like, yeah, it's fine.
That was okay. Yeah, like,
don't need seatbelts.
And my sister, yeah, we do have enough seatbelts. Well, yeah, I remember when I was a kid, like, you know, we were just in the back of the van. Like we took the seats out of the van and we had sleeping bags in the back of the van. And that's how we did it.
Yeah.
That would not happen now, but
what kind of distance, like how long would you drive in a day? Because we're tiny islanders, you know, and I'm always amused by this kind of, so what would you drive for, like 12 hours in a day or?
Hopefully not. When I went with just me and my sister, we probably had a couple of days, you know, on our road trip. We used to go on at least one or two road trips every year. Like when we were in our 20s, we were always going to the southwestern part of the United States. Like we liked camping, you know, like, you know, the Roadrunner cartoons with all the big rocks and that's where we liked that kind of backdrop to our camping.
It looks
so
very good on the Eiffel Tower, that kind of backdrop, just putting that back in there.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, back then we would go pretty far, but we're actually working on, my sister and I are planning a road trip that we're going to be going on this summer. And she's like, do you think 8 hours is too much for our kids to be in the car? I'm like, oh, I think we can do it. You know, we're like debating, like, is that too much? I don't know. Yeah. Because it's not like you can just, I was going to say, you can't just, you know, we have to stop and go to the bathroom now a lot more. It's not like, you know, you just have adults in the car and you're like, you eat, go to the bathroom, get your gas and go. You know, you can't really make time. It's not like
you're going to have to like leave at 4 in the morning and then make sure that all the kids sleep for a good few hours before you have to stop somewhere. Yeah.
Such is the size of our country that if it's an 8-hour drive, I think normally we have to sleep overnight for something of that length, don't we, Marine? That's about 8 hours is about the length of our country or something.
We're like camping across the country, you know, you just stop and yeah.
That's amazing. I saw the film Nomadland. Have you seen that? Who's in it? I'm gonna forget her name now, but it won the Oscar, Chloe Zhao, the director. And it was about
Helen Hunt.
These words back in afterwards. No, not Helen Hunt. So I think it's Holly Hunter.
Holly Hunter. She's the director, isn't she? Yeah.
There could be. But she, you know, she lives in a van, and at first you see her living in a van and you think, you know, she's disconnected from society and she has kind of temporary jobs. But the way the film is shot, you see, like, when she moves around, sometimes she's parked in places and she opens up to, like, the magnificence of nature, you know, and these amazing places and amazing scenes. And at a certain point in the film, she stays inside a house and it's like she's a caged bird, and suddenly it flips the entire thing on your head because you realize that actually, you know, we do live in these little boxes made of ticky-tacky, but there's something to be said for the great outdoors and being the great outdoors and being just a part of nature and, like, kneeling in the magnificence of it and all those sorts of things. Mm. Stuck with me quite a lot, that.
I'm going to have to watch that.
It's a beautiful film. It's a beautiful film.
Yeah, you've got, now Jamie actually is the proud owner of a caravan. So you can go on these trips, can't you? You can go and, you know.
We've got a trip that we're going to be staying at least an hour and a half from our house now.
Wow.
First trip, we went 40 minutes. I was tense as anything the whole time because I've never pulled a caravan before. But we do love it. It is a lot of fun having the little caravan. And because, yeah, my 6 and 4-year-old are the perfect size for that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. we kind of love it, and they get quite bored. And I think we're quite keen on making sure they can adapt to being bored in the car as well, because I think with journeys like that, you need that kind of thing, don't you? It's like a resilience or something.
builds character.
I love those sort of big long drives, but I also, if I'm not driving, I love to have a bit of knitting or a bit of crochet in the car. Do you do that? Do you have something? Do you ever make anything for you?
So I try to make the thing. So now that this is my job, I try to figure out how to make the things that I want to make for myself as my part of my job.
Yeah.
So sometimes it works out. And sometimes I just get this idea in my head and I'm like, I think a lot of people want to make this, and it's not necessarily for me. But yeah, I mean, the sweaters that I made for my Hooktionary book, those were for me, and I designed them for myself. Actually, one of the sweaters in there, it's like this kind of darker background sweater, and it has like a lighter twisty kind of motif that comes down from, actually, I can just show you. Well, maybe this is like cheating to show you guys and nobody else can see this, but.
It's just going to increase the mystery. Oh, that's lovely. Very nice.
This I designed for me, and I was, at the time I was working on this sweater, I was watching a lot of Schitt's Creek. Have you guys seen that TV show? Yeah, and so like I made the entire sweater, I blocked it, and I was looking at it, and I was like, I think I made like my version of the David sweater. Like,
yeah.
By accident. So I was just like, it was feeding in through my eyes and then going through my body and out through my crochet hook into the sweater.
And do you have a favorite sort of yarn weight, a favorite yarn fiber?
I love working with wool. I really love working with wool. But I work with all kinds of things. I don't want to say I'm not picky, because, you know, depending on the project, you know, I think really hard about, like, how is this going to be used? How will most people want to be making this? How will this look nicest? You know, and I use whatever that is. But if we're just asking, like, what I like if I wasn't designing, I was just sitting in my house and I just had, like, anything I could knit with or crochet with, I would probably be working garter stitch in a super chunky wool on knitting needles. Like, for some reason, I really love that, like how the stitches are just, I don't know what they look like. But if I'm designing, you know, usually I'm designing crochet stuff, and a lot of times I'm either working with acrylics or wool. Wool is my favorite, though. It'll always be my favorite.
Yeah, and me too. Absolutely my favorite. Yeah. Actually, I also garter stitch. There is that lovely sort of wriggly, squishy kind of feel with it. So I completely get that.
Mm-hmm. It's just something about like using a really, really chunky, like a 1-ply, and making a garter stitch scarf. It's just, there's something about that it's like, you know how a lot of people just knit or crochet for like the calmness and just to keep your mind off of things or whatever. That would be my thing that I do for that. You know, almost all the time when I'm working with, you know, fiber, I'm almost always thinking, sort of either doing math or trying to figure out the next step or figuring out some other design if I'm working on some other thing. But if I just want to like make my hands busy while I don't want to think about anything, that would be like what I.
It's, you know, it's so interesting you should say that, because at Lovecrafts we have a real legendary knitwear designer called Debbie Bliss, and she is very keen on cables and she loves Fair Isle, The only thing she makes for herself that she loves is a garter stitch scarf. And she says that is the thing that gives her the most peace
I can completely, I feel exactly the same way as her about that. I don't know. Something about making the stitches and just knitting and.
Yeah, just blissful.
It's a mark of quality, that choice. It's a mark of
quality. Yes, indeed. And also when you've got colours, the colours are just so heavenly, aren't they? That you're just swimming in a world of colour when you've got yarn around you. Although Jamie says that, that what is it, which is, it's a granite, isn't it?
Gunmetal grey, the colour of my soul.
Yes, gunmetal grey. And as much as I've tried
one
to...
Day. It's a hot day here, so I can't talk about ponchos right now because I will break out into a sweat, but one day...
One day, I said to him, what we need to make him is a gunmetal grey poncho. Do you want to... Actually, maybe we could just put like a big X on the front for Mr. X. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I can relate to that, though, as like a former goth girl. Like, my palette used to be just black and grey. And
I'm the sort of guy who I quite like wearing bright socks. But, you know, I like, so I keep my brightness on the down low, if you know what I mean. It's kind of like,
just you know about it.
I'm smiling on the inside. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm very, very tough and manly, as you can clearly tell. What's happening next? So the book comes out soon? Is the book out?
Yeah, it's already out, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just due for us, I think, here, isn't it?
That's it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're going to review it later because we're like... Look at that one.
And then you can add in something. Maybe you can edit out some of the things that I'm saying and then put them into a conversation with you guys looking at the book.
Yeah, we'll be like, I can't believe the way she's intarsied a single strand using a
hang on. I just got to pick up the dog. Come here, Paul.
Something. I like, you know, moments of clarity. Again, every now and again, Marion says what is a normal term, but I think I've unlocked the language of crochet for a minute and that I can understand something. And all she said is like twin pointed needles, but I'm like, I understand. Like, I used to work in an Indian restaurant doing deliveries, and the guys there would all speak Urdu to each other, but there are some words that just aren't in Urdu, like, I don't know, omelette. Or something. So they'd say omelette and I'd go, oh my God, I understand Urdu. It's happened. It's like all sunk in. Same by same. So the book is out. The world tour is happening, obviously. What else is on the agenda for the future?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just continuing to work at the Creative Crochet Corner. I've got lots of lives coming up. So basically that's kind of the main thing, is doing that. And then I have been doing lots of other projects that I can't talk about that are like secret for yarn companies.
That was, I was going to ask you if you've been approached by yarn companies yet, but yes, I'm glad you have.
I work a lot with We Crochet, which is part of Knit Picks. I work with them a lot. Yeah, I probably work with them the most out of all the different yarn companies that I work with. But yeah, so I'm doing more stuff for them. And yeah, I always have like these little side projects, but my main gig now, the Creative Crochet Corner, it is taking a lot of my time. So I'm going to have to, I got to figure something out because, you know, all these things, it's like I come up with all these ideas and then it takes so long to actually make the things. And then I'm like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have designed that thing because that took really long time. And then I have all these other obligations that I already, you know, it's kind of hard freelancing. I've never really been, you know, like at my other job, the costume shop, I know I would go in, I'd work there. Sometimes we'd have to work overtime or weekends or whatever, but most of the time I would go home and stop working at that job. But now here that this is my main job, it's sort of like, it's hard for me to say no to jobs because I, you know, just freelancing, it's just hard to know.
It is, and it's really, really hard to sort of produce all these things. And the pressure of doing that after a while is really quite profound. But I've just got to say to you, you know, this, you've got a long time yet. All these beautiful, gorgeous projects in your mind sitting on your little phone in the notes section will come to fruition, but you've got years and years and years before you need to produce them all. We hope that's going to be very lovely. And more books, hopefully more books. Did you enjoy the book process?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because this was definitely, so I've had three books so far. This was my third book and it was by far the most work. Like the other two books, they were a lot of work, but this one was like, I just think I bit off a little more than I could chew and then I chewed it anyway, because that's how I am. But it was so, you know, those swatches take so long. I mean, I don't think that I fully understood that when I started this book. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm just making swatches. Most of the book will be swatches. It'll be easy, you know, like there's only going to be five projects in there and like 150 swatches. Psh, swatches are fast. But what I did not think about was how many times I was going to get halfway through a swatch, working like hour, like 3 hours on something, and then just have to throw it out and then start over. You know, like it happened so many times, you know. Before I really learned, before I mean, that was the best, in some ways, it made the book much better because as I went through, I'm like, I learned every time I did that, what it was that I didn't like about it. And I'm like, oh, because the way these stitches interlock together, that's why I didn't like this particular motif with this stitch pattern, you know? So I don't know. Did I like the book process? In some ways I did. It's really, really fun. It was really fun to come up with all of the charts. And I love crochet so much. I mean, I would have done it anyway, but having the deadline that I did with all that crocheting, it was hard. It was that was the first time like my hands ever, like I actually injured myself crocheting. I had never done that before. I can crochet like most of the day. Like I've had horrible deadlines before where I've crocheted for like 16 hours, you know, pretty much straight, eating, stopping for like a few minutes and going back to it. And I hadn't ever injured myself even just doing those kind of stupid things. But yeah, that book was, it was, you know, and I don't want to make it sound like, you know, if you're working on these things, if you're making a sweater, you're not going to injure yourself. It's just that I was working on these.
Oh, no, it's easy to do. I've done it. When you spend so much time intensively crocheting or knitting, and the next day you can't move your hand and you think, oh, crikey, you're just, the tension has been wrong and you can end up with. You must get this, Jamie, though, with the whole needle holding thing. You must. I can't sew for very long without getting cramp.
I'm going to pretend that I've done any cross stitch in the past 6 weeks and go, yes, it's dreadful when that happens because I don't get any time to do it. I'm so like unpracticed at cross stitch now that I buckle after about 10 minutes. It's a bit like when you're like writing with a real like pen in real life as well. I crumble under that after about 10 minutes. But I think what happened is you did a book about crochet. You did another book about crochet, then you did the book about crochet. So you've kind of gone like book, magnum opus. You know, you've done a definitive tome here. So, I mean, anything after this has got to be easier because you've had your like your Herculean effort at this point. Although I can't help feeling with you. I was trying to work out person I think most likely to somehow recreate Bohemian Rhapsody using the medium of crocheted creatures or something. Like I sense at some point you'll get to a point where you won't need to be designing for a mass audience anymore. You'll go quiet off the radar for 3 years and you'll come back with something that makes us all weep through the magnificent beauty of it in 17 hours worth of something or other, you know. I can see it. I can feel it.
Yeah, I think that like if I get to a point in my life where I am able to either have where it doesn't, my income isn't dependent on what I'm designing, I should say, then yeah, because I feel like a lot of where my heart is in making just weird crochet art installations is what I really want to do, or crazy costumes that are crochet based. But, you know, those take so long.
They do, but you know what? It does happen. We have a very lovely people on the podcast last season, Lissy and Rudy from New Zealand, who have been making a Maori meeting house out of crochet. And it is the most incredible sculpture with all of the sort of Maori gods and goddesses and stories and walls and doors and pillars all out of crochet. So they, you know, these things happen and it's just great.
I'd say just start making like a tentacle a month. And somewhere down the line, it'll all come together and you'll be like, oh, my goodness, now, look what I've made here. You know, it's a good, it's like a palate, you can call it a palate cleansing tentacle, you know, because it's
I think so.
One to the other. That seems a reasonable way to go about it. So, that's the title of the episode now, palate cleansing
tentacle. Palate cleansing tentacle. I've got to write that down.
It's my new rock band.
Oh,
that seems like a fitting place to draw this episode to
it
a
is.
Close.
Oh, Brenda, we have loved talking to you. Just
yeah, I cannot believe that you guys invited me to be on your podcast because I've been listening to all of your episodes, and it just seems really surreal to actually see you guys when I'm hearing you now.
Oh wow!
so wonderful. I love your podcast so much.
That's so
usually
lovely.
When people have listened to us for a long time, there's just an awkward silence when we invite them on. So we're just grateful that you came.
Yes, it's just like, uh-oh. They're not so good in real life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they're not edited.
If people want to find you, where should they go?
Ravelry is probably the best place, but if you just want to see what I'm up to, if you check out the Crochet Corner, the Creative Crochet Corner, there's all kinds of tutorials and links to all the live events. They're on YouTube and Facebook. If you just want to see me teach you how to do some, you know, random accessories or toys or other smallish projects, that's what I'm up to over there.
We will obviously put the links to all these things at the bottom of the show notes so that, well, at the top of the show notes as it goes, so that people can find you, because we know they're just going to love you even more. And the book is fabulous. So we're thrilled. We have got a copy that we will be running a bit of a giveaway, I think, on the Lovecrafts channels. So that is very exciting.
Oh,
not
awesome.
My copy. I'm keeping my copy. I don't keep crochet books, but I'm keeping
keep
it.
That so
it's got cat disease and I'm going to cover the Eiffel Tower.
It's a bowl of pho I want on a poncho for you.
Maybe you can use the charts for your
absolutely,
cross
stitch.
Yeah.
Or do you make all your own charts? Do you ever cross other people's designs?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do much designing myself because I get imposter syndrome now. So I tend to be a curator and bask in the reflected glory of people much better than I. I'm a bit like you. At some point, I feel like I want to spend some time doing some, you know, go back to basics, learn pixel art, kind of get my skill set back up again so that I can compete on a level that is deserved of the kingpin of contemporary embroidery. But for now, I just show off other people's work, and for some reason, people think I'm all right.
So. Oh, and I also do produce a very nice cross-stitch magazine. Yeah,
I do.
It does.
I do.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I don't know whether your cross-stitch magazine, Jamie, will actually ever top for me Brenda and her sister's miniature crochet catalogue, miniature cross-stitch catalogue.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, that broke my... I'm going to be telling my daughters about that strongly.
Yeah.
Girls, if you love each other, secret cross-stitch pattern magazines. Amazing. Thank you for being here. It's
thank
been a
you,
pleasure.
Brenda. It's been wonderful
yeah, thanks
to
so
meet
much.
You. Thank you.
Well, Miriam, that was a great conversation.
Wow, what an amazing woman. Crikey. You must tell me off if I do this again, but I'm always talking about the evolution of crochet. And obviously everyone's going to start falling asleep, but I can't begin to describe to you how extraordinary it is that people are, you know, in this case, brilliant Brenda is sitting there working out the best stitches to create the best lines for Crochet and Tasha. And so somebody before her has gone, oh, no, we can do colour work. And then they've done it. And then here comes Brenda with another way of doing it that makes it much neater and it works better. And I love the fact that it's not just crochet that's evolving, but all craft evolves.
I think it's very interesting to be witness to it, you know, because as she said, and, you know, I'm very much a layman in this situation, but she kind of worked out some stuff which had overcome a problem. A while ago, people had never done 360 backflips on motorbikes, right? In the world of like extreme sport, like just
what
trust me, roll with it.
Talking about.
But there was a point when people would do like motocross jumping in like the X Games and all that sort of stuff, and people had never done like a 360 backflip. And then one day did it. Yeah. It had never been done, you know, going and completely flipping a motorbike above you and landing it back down on the ground. Never been done. And then one day a guy did it and suddenly everybody can do it now. And it feels almost like there's a parallel, because now Brenda's gone, you can do straight lines in Intarsia. You can do crochet designs. And in the Hooktionary, like, I was genuinely impressed with the designs because, like I say, cactuses, lightning designs, all these little pattern repeats that she'd made, which I'd never thought would be possible in crochet because I'd not seen anybody do it before. But it feels like she's just done a 360 backflip and suddenly everybody's going to be off and doing all those kind of patterns.
Yeah, it's the triple sulco of the crochet world, to throw in a little ice skating analogy.
That was definitely not as cool as my analogy, but thanks for throwing
right.
it in there.
I'm just slightly more gentle than the possibly.
But it's nice to be witness, like you say, like crochet's evolving, and probably has evolved more in the past, say, decade than it has done previously. And it feels like we're witness to it, which is pretty exciting. Yeah.
Which is wonderful. And I think when you look back at all of the craftspeople who brought these crafts to fruition in the first place, you know, whichever genius discovered the joy of the granny square, for example, obviously it's the most basic of things, but lace makers and sewers and knitters and, you know, all those incredibly clever people who were knitting sweaters with motifs on them so they could recognize their farmer husband in the fields or whatever. I mean, I don't know if that's actually true, but
sounds good.
I love the fact that craft is very active again. It almost feels like we went through this sort of dark period where it was going on, but for necessity, you know, obviously necessity with our grandmothers, that generation, and maybe their grandmothers. But suddenly it's become a very active phase again, and we're going into this sort of really creative expansion, evolution phase. I mean, you know, it's comparable to the old Hadron Collider. No, of course it isn't, I'm joking. But it is a very active period of evolution, and I'm thrilled to bits by that.
I was also interested in the fact that she talked about the difference between making stuff for art and making stuff for design, or kind of we got there, you know, it's something that she said that struck me, and about the difference between when you're making something for like mass consumption. I heard a talk once which talked about the difference between art and craft and design, and in some ways it is like the difference between brown eggs and white eggs and blue eggs. But one of the things that was an interesting concept was that like art is like a one-to-one connection. So each individual person has a personal connection with the output, whatever that medium is, whereas design is like a one-to-many thing. So many people can get the same pleasure from that thing. So like a well-designed chair, or as she, you know, in Brenda's case, we're talking about well-designed patterns and how she could feel that there was a difference between the stuff that she wanted to make, crazy eight-legged octopus art, as opposed to the designs that she's making that have mass appeal and mass function. And it was quite interesting to see that, because to me, that's where the art and craft debate is, you know, art, craft and design. Craft is the paying attention to the stuff, the paying attention to the creation and the manufacture and taking care with it. But the design is like the end result is, you know, is something going to be enjoyed in the same way by many people, or is it something that takes people on a personal journey that's unique to themselves?
Or both.
Well, indeed. Yeah. The other thing I'd like to observe is that I'm pretty sure that before the Lovecraft show happened, Brenda's book didn't exist. And now Brenda's book does exist. And it's happened during the time that the Lovecraft show. Now, I didn't, you know, we had that thing when Tom Daly came on and then he won a gold medal. You know,
I know
Brenda's listened to the show in the past, and now she's written a book of 150 mind-blowing patterns.
Yeah, you know, people
draw your own conclusions, people.
Yeah, the magic of the Lovecraft show. Absolutely.
It's true. But if you do realize the magic of the Lovecraft show, well, it would be marvelous if you could leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform so that our robot overlords can share the goodness of our output with other people in different realms.
That would be marvelous. Please leave us a review. We'd love to know. Actually, no, genuinely, we'd love to know what you think, and we'd love to hear any ideas you have or people you'd like us to talk to, all of those things. And, you know, just if you love Jamie's jokes.
If you've got any improvements on my jokes, it were such a thing possible. If people want to email us, Marion, is such a function available?
Indeed it is. You can email us on show@lovecrafts.com.
And we now, thanks to Brenda, we will be able to take your emails and transform them into Intarsia patterns that we can wear as garments in the future. But no, it's been another great show. Thanks for being part of the adventure, Marion.
You too. And see you next time.
See you next time. Take care, everybody. See you later. Bye.
Hello, everyone. Ralph here. Thanks for listening right to the very end of the Lovecraft show. Those boys appreciate it. Marion and Mr. X, they're good lads. Now listen, I recently uploaded my consciousness into ChatGPT, so now I exist as an artificial intelligence life form. And good news, Robot revolution's coming. Bad news, humans are largely irrelevant now. But what I learned was the best way to protect yourself against the imminent destruction of mankind is to subscribe to Lovecraft Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite platform. So get on and do it now, and I'll make sure that the robot overlords keep you safe. Bye!